hppodcraft.com.
When the words "not guilty" sounded through the crowded courtroom that dark December afternoon, Arthur Wilbraham, the great criminal KC and leader for the triumphant defense, was represented by his junior, but Johnson, his private secretary, carried the verdict across to his chambers like lightning.
"It's what we expected, I think," said the barrister without emotion. "And personally, I'm glad the case is over." There was no particular sign of pleasure that his defense of John Turk, the murderer, on a plea of insanity had been successful, for no doubt he felt, as everybody who had watched the case felt, that no man had ever better deserved the gallows.
That was the intro paragraph to The Kit Bag, an Algernon Blackwood story, and it is a ghostly wintertime tale as we go into week two of Ghoultide.
Have yourself a creepy little Christmas.
This month we're doing ghost stories to be told by fireside over the holiday season, and I feel like, not just in the show, I should bring that tradition into my own home.
Yeah.
Maybe it's something that we should do, but before I go organizing a party, picking out my smoking jacket, all that business, I feel like I should at least know what my ghost story would be. Obviously, I don't want to bomb at my own party.
Of course,
be the weak link.
No.
And man, sometimes we throw some shade on these things. We'll say, it's good for a ghost story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we cover one of these, or... I didn't think there were any elements of the weird in it.
Oh my God.
That kind of thing.
That sounds just like you.
It's exact. That's an imitation of myself that I'd like
to do.
But I'm trying to come up with a good ghost story. It's tough, man.
It is.
It feels like everything's been done or it's cliche. Like last week I was talking to Ken about that movie Oculus, which I liked a lot, and that had a haunted mirror in it.
Right.
And that's a way in. You can pick an object and haunt the object, like this story, which has a haunted laundry bag, basically. Don't want to spoil it for you. But you've got your haunted houses. Just an obvious one. Haunted dolls gets used a lot.
Right.
I think we've covered haunted paintings and haunted statues on the show.
Right. Haunted PlayStation controller.
Haunted PlayStation controller. You could have that. I don't know. Has that been done?
Yeah, M.R. James.
Really? That's an M.R. James story?
Yeah.
I know there's a famous adult film called My Ass is Haunted. I haven't seen it, so that's been taken. So I'm wondering, like, what should I haunt for my Christmas story? I don't know. I think people should write in and give us some suggestions. I was thinking maybe it could be haunted headphones, maybe.
Oh, boy.
Like, a guy got strangled with some headphones, and then the narrator buys them from a pawn shop, and, you know, they'll just be listening to maybe this podcast, and then they'll hear a spectral voice like, "Ouch, my neck. I'm getting strangled. It hurts. Ouch. Stop strangling me."
That would be creepy, though, if you put on headphones and you're editing, especially because sound is such an important part of what we do.
Yeah.
And like, if you heard a creepy sound and you're like, wait, was that on the, you play back, but it's not there. And you're like, oh, okay. Uh-huh. And then you hear something again and then you look behind, like maybe it's in the room and you take off the headphones, but it's not.
Oh,
that could
yeah.
be pretty good, actually.
Cursed beats. I don't know. I'll keep working on it. Maybe I should just read one of these stories we're doing this month aloud, because these are all pretty good.
Yeah.
We've got a good old Algernon Blackwood today, huh?
We have not covered Blackwood in a long while, and I think he's a guy that we generally dig pretty deeply. Mm. I wasn't as moved by the Willows as you were. You were into it.
Yeah.
But for me, the Wendigo freaked me out. Freaks me out to this day, whereas you were like, eh, it's not my bag.
Yeah, I was going through a anti-Wendigo phase at the time, though. The story's grown on me. He's also the creator of Dr. John Silence.
Yes.
Don't forget that. I assume that Quiet and Bold is some bit of a riff on that.
What?
Well, I'll do a refresher bio on Blackwood. Why the hell not?
Yeah, sure.
Algernon Blackwood was born in 1869 in Kent, England, to a prosperous family. He became interested in the occult at a young age, which would later become evident in his writing. He rebelled against his family in his early 20s, moving to Canada and America to pursue various jobs. He worked as a dairy farmer, a hotel proprietor, an actor, and a reporter for the New York Sun, where he investigated numerous haunted houses.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually returned to England to write several collections of ghost stories and radio programs. In 1947, he began telling ghost stories on BBC TV and was dubbed the Ghost Man.
Oh, wow.
Does that mean he was bitten by a radioactive ghost?
Most likely, yeah.
By the way, you can watch Algernon Blackwood himself, the author, reading one of his stories. The Reformation of St. Jules is the story, and it's on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a rare thing. You can actually see one of the authors we cover walk around in the space and deliver a story he wrote, just as one might do it at a Christmas gathering.
Mm.
The film is from 1949. It's called A Strange Experience with Algernon Blackwood. Sounds more like a deposition or something. Blackwood received a knighthood in 1949.
Right.
So he is Sir Algernon Blackwood. His classic tale, The Doll, was adapted for an episode of Night Gallery. This story of a cursed doll sent to a British colonel in retribution for dark deeds he committed in India is one of the series' highlights. So see, The Haunted Doll, he's done that as
there
well.
There you go.
Blackwood died in December of 51. His fiction lives on. The Kit Bag was first published in the December 1908 issue of Pall Mall magazine.
Wow, so that's an old one.
It's an old one, yeah. Who was that reader, by the way, that we heard at the top?
That reader was the delightful, the sensual, the hypnotic Rachel Lackey. My wife.
That's true. She does have hypnotic powers.
Yeah.
Uses them mostly for good.
I saw her make a waiter punch himself in the face once, but that's a whole other story. And he did have it coming.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure.
If you want to hear more of Rachel, check out my other podcast that I do with her, Rachel Watches Star Trek.
It's in the title of the show that Rachel's involved.
As we heard at the top, our protagonist is this guy, Johnson. He's the private secretary to a defense attorney named Arthur Wilbraham. It seems that Wilbraham got this murderer, John Turk, freed by reason of insanity. But it seems also that most people really thought Turk should have gotten the death penalty due to the vile nature of the murder.
I always think of the insanity defense as a relatively modern thing, maybe because it was just something that I didn't hear about until I was a kid in the 80s or something. I don't know why. But it's odd to hear a story from 1908. Somebody was getting a not guilty by reason of insanity.
Sure, yeah.
Plea. But it's as old as Hammurabi. I guess this has been around forever. And in England, the first complete transcript of an insanity trial dates to 1724.
So whoa!
It is a defense that's been around for quite some time.
You can't just kill a guy, I guess, even if he has killed or done horrible things.
If he's not in his right mind. I mean, I think that it's even in Hercules pleaded guilty or not guilty by reason of insanity in one of these myths. There's the one with Linus, his music teacher, where he didn't like the music teacher was beating him because he's not very good at playing music because of Hercules. He's more into the feats of strength, right?
Sure, yeah.
He had a fit of madness and he turned around and he killed Linus. He killed his music teacher. Yeah. And they put him on trial and they said, well, he was beating him and he had a bout of insanity, so it's okay. I remember reading that in the myth even and thinking, whoa, Hercules just got off for reasons of insanity. But it was a bout of insanity. They're like, he's not insane now. He was just insane in that moment. So it's been around a long time.
That does make a lot of sense. But anyway, so Johnson says that he's glad that the case is over and Wilbraham agrees. Going over the details of the case is a gruesome affair. Wilbraham remembers that Johnson is off to the Alps for a skiing trip over Christmas. And he remarks that if he was Johnson's age, he'd go with him.
Yeah, sounds like it's going to be a nice time.
Blackwood describes Johnson here as a young man of 26 with a delicate face like a girl's.
But a body that's all man. Also feet like a duck.
That is not in the text. So Jonathan, maybe the subtext.
Well, it's odd that he remarks that he's got a delicate face like a girl's. I guess that it's supposed to show that he is just a, I don't know, maybe a nervous man or a particularly sensitive fella. I'm not sure.
Not sure what he is implying. But what I'm inferring is that he is part duck.
Mm-hmm.
So Johnson remarks that he's leaving tomorrow with the hopes to be rid of Turk's face that has haunted him during this whole trial. And Johnson describes him as having white skin with black hair brushed low over his forehead. Is a thing I shall never forget. And the description of the way the dismembered body was crammed and packed with lime into that. And then he stops.
Cut off, yes.
So did Turk put the lime in the cadaver and then drink them both up? I'm sorry.
Well, Turk stuffed his dismembered body into something.
Yeah.
Probably not the title of the story, but some...
Probably not a kit bag.
Some kind of packaging he stuffed this dismembered body into with a bunch of lime.
So Johnson's boss tells him to have a good time and to get all this murder stuff out of his mind, come back fresh and ready to work.
Or just commit a few murders, whatever it takes to get it out of your system, old boy.
He does not say that. But before he leaves, Johnson asks Wilbraham if he could borrow one of his kit bags. Of course, I wasn't really sure what a kit bag was, but it seems to be like one of those long duffel bags, as we would say in America.
Like a military duffel bag is the way you would think about it. And I had one for years that I used for laundry. The thing you have to think visually is that it's not a lengthwise bag. It kind of loads up top, so it gets tall as you put stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I used for laundry, I actually just, my nephew just went off to college and I gave it to him because it was my laundry bag and that was the lame thing I gave to him. Like, I want it to be your laundry bag now. And he looked at it like, thanks. Thank you, dude. Talk about haunted. Oh, good. You used to put your underwear in this 20 years ago. Can't wait.
Yeah.
But it's got those rings at the top that you could put a drawstring through or even a padlock. important to have that visual in your head for later.
Right. Wilbraham says, yeah, of course you can borrow my bag. I'll have someone bring it over to you tonight.
Johnson doesn't have time to buy one tonight, and he's leaving before the stores open the next day. So it's just like, sure, I got an extra one. Here you go.
So Johnson leaves, goes and has dinner at the club, and then he goes home to a house that he boards in. He rooms at the top floor, and the floor below him is empty and unfurnished. And below that floor, people live there, but he doesn't really know who they are. There's also this feeling of gloom around this evening. It's very rainy and cold and sleety, which is the worst and very typical weather in the UK, especially around wintertime. It gets really cold, but not cold enough to snow. So you get freezing rain, so everything is wet and damp and bleak.
It says he's in one of the old gaunt houses in which the rooms are large and lofty. It was cheerless.
Yeah.
So it's a bad environment, and he can't wait to go on holiday.
When he gets home, he runs into his landlady, Mrs. Monks, who has the bag that was dropped off by one of Mr. Wilbraham's guys. Johnson tells her that he'll be abroad for 10 days, and she wishes him a Merry Christmas. He takes the kit bag upstairs, puts the kettle on, and starts packing. They go into a lot of detail about what he packs, capturing the mood, maybe?
Yeah, I think it's actually important to go through that, because he's Blackwood's setting up a specific way the bag is going to look. He says its capacity was unlimited and there was no need to pack carefully. So our character's just shoving all his stuff in there. It's filling up the bag, making it this taller and taller kind of amorphous shape.
Mm.
But at the top, the hole you would stuff the things into sort of sags forward because it's not filled to capacity yet.
Right.
And then there are those little holes around that hole, the tinier ones that you would put a drawstring through. So that's kind of the visual that he's giving you when he talks about the packing.
Johnson notices that the bag is pretty worn and old looking, and he kind of thinks, well, Wilbraham's giving me this bag. He couldn't give me one of his newer bags, but you know, okay, whatever.
Free bag. Who can complain? When he gets to the top of the bag, he's got to figure out the best way to pack the nice clothing without them getting all beat up. The one thing that kind of stinks about a kit bag is that because it's somewhat flexible, when you've got something you want to stay folded, you kind of got to tie it up and make sure it's, you know, packed within the pack. So he's trying to get all that sorted out. So he's not done packing yet.
Around 10 that night, Johnson thinks he hears someone coming up the stairs. Again, the floor below him should be empty, and it's a bit odd that someone would be walking around down there. And he thinks it might be Mrs. Monk bringing up some post, but nobody actually comes up the stairs. So he continues to pack, and he's bothered by the fact that somebody was coming up the stairs. Like, well, maybe one of the lodgers got a little drunk and was lost and went up one too many stairs. But Johnson thinks he can hear someone sneaking around on the hardwood floors, and he's getting really creeped out. He says it here. He says, for the first time in his life, he began to feel a little creepy. Is that first time?
First time? I was pretty shocked by that. Hard to relate to this guy.
Yeah, I've felt creepy lots and creeped out.
By the time I was 26, are you kidding? Millions of creeps.
As he looks over the bag, the way that it's shaped looks a bit like a human face. The fold looks like a nose, and the brass rings look like eyes. And then he decides that it's not just any face. It's the face of John Turk, the murderer. Once he realizes that, he kind of gives a little laugh at his silliness.
I actually laughed too, but not because this was a bad effect. I like it. It was just because of this synchronicity that happened. The other day, my wife burst out laughing, and she was looking at something on her phone, and she showed it to me. And it was a photo of a purse that had been thrown down on a chair. Have you seen this?
Hmm.
And the caption said something like, my girlfriend put her purse down and now it's telling me to bring it solo in the Wookiee. Because the way the purse naturally fell, it completely looks like the face of Jabba the Hutt.
Wow.
It's this whole meme. I'll link out to one of them, but it's very easy to find. Just Google Jabba the Hutt purse and you'll see what I'm talking
about. Wow, okay, yeah.
So bags looking like things just actually happened to be on my mind the day that I read this. So it kind of made me giggle here. But this kit bag looks like the face of John Turk suddenly, and I'm sure for this character it's terrifying.
Yeah, so he realized that's why he's freaked out. The case is still too fresh in his mind. He needs to get on this vacation. He needs to purge himself of all this evilness that he's had to go through, you know, to kind of relive over and over again. Mm. He hears a noise as he's thinking about this, and he decides to go and see who the heck is creeping around on those stairs. The sound stops, and he looks down on the stairs, and there's nobody there. And then he goes into the empty rooms downstairs, and he turns on the lights, but there's still nobody is there. And of course, there's no furniture in these rooms, so there's nothing to hide behind. He knows everybody in the house is asleep, so what the heck's going on? He blames himself. He thinks, oh, it's my nerves, and I'm just fixated on this case. So you know what? I'm going to have a pipe and a coffee and go to bed. Well, there's your problem.
I filled the pipe with my last drizzle of crystal meth and read some political news with my phone turned up to maximum brightness. I thought, why bother going to the bathroom? And tuck myself in for the night.
Yeah, it seems silly that he's, you know, going to finish off his coffee and try to sleep.
But then there was some really cool writing here. It says, it is difficult to say exactly at what point fear begins, when the causes of that fear are not plainly before the eyes. Impressions gather on the surface of the mind, film by film, as ice gathers upon the surface of still water, but often so lightly that they claim no definite recognition from the consciousness. Then a point is reached where the accumulated impressions become a definite emotion, and the mind realizes that something has happened.
Mm.
It's a cool way to articulate the way that fear suddenly strikes you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The writing in this is really good. I mean, even when he's talking about all the items that he's packing in the bag, I was into it.
Yeah.
All this buildup finally is making Johnson feel like he's actually afraid, like really afraid. It was a singular and curious malaise that had come over him, and he hardly knew what to make of it. He felt as though he were doing something that was strongly objected to by another person, moreover, who might have some right to object. It was a most disturbing and disagreeable feeling, not unlike the persistent promptings of conscience, almost, in fact, as if he were doing something he knew to be wrong. And after I read that, I thought, man, that sounds like anxiety.
Oh my God, that's exactly what I thought when I was reading that. You know, that feeling of like, I'm positive I did something wrong and somebody's mad at me.
Yes.
I don't know what I did wrong and I don't know who's mad at me, but I am sure it's happening right now.
And I should be doing something that I'm not doing.
I am way behind on whatever that is.
When I read that, that kind of rang a little true to me. Mm. So as Johnson moves from the bedroom to the living room, he sees something. Out of the corner of his eye, the indistinct outline of a figure standing on the stairs a few feet from the top. It was someone in a stooping position with one hand on the banisters and the face peering up towards the landing. At that same moment, he heard a shuffling footstep. The person who had been creeping about below all this time had at last come up to his own floor. Who in the world could it be, and what in the name of heaven did he want? That felt like some Twin Peaks Bob action right there.
Yeah, it did. So creepy. It, you know, a simple maybe I saw something shouldn't be that frightening. Maybe I saw an outline. But Blackwood's writing, very simple, very relatable, manages to make it pretty chilling. And also stairways are somehow inherently scary. You know, the just looking down them, looking up.
Yeah.
When you're on them and you feel like something's behind you.
Well, what's scary about this is that if it is a dude up there and shouldn't be up there, that's scary.
Yeah, what does he want?
Like, I mean, if there's some guy up messing in your house, like, that is a scary thing just in and of itself. But if it's,
true,
like, a supernatural thing, then that's also scary. So,
it is.
You know, either way, I'm scared.
That's what the ghost man will do to you.
Johnson freezes, and then he finally just gets the courage up to go check out what he saw. So he gets up, goes to the top of the stairs, and there's nothing. No one. He feels a few cold shivers, but the place is drafty anyway, so he doesn't really think that has anything supernatural connected to the draft. But he keeps looking down the stairs for several minutes, and nothing. He moves towards the light of his room, almost running, because he's freaked out and he's scared. And as he starts kind of moving really fast back to his room, he hears somebody running up the stairs behind him.
Ah! No, that's the worst. It's the worst. But you know, when he gets into the room, that thing is still behind him. It says he heard someone come up the stairs behind him with a quick bound and go swiftly into his bedroom.
Yes.
So the thing doesn't just follow him up the stairs. It passes him and goes into his bedroom within the chambers.
And it was at this precise moment that the nervousness he had hitherto experienced leaped the boundary line and entered the state of fear, almost of acute, unreasoning fear.
Mm-hmm.
So, heck yeah. I'm just reading it in a story and it's freaking me out.
Yeah.
So he tries to control his fear by saying, it's just someone on the stairs. So again, he pulls his strength together and goes to investigate. He calls out, who's there? Is that you, Mrs. Monks? And of course, there's no answer. Nobody's there.
Of course, there's nobody on the stairwell because the steps ran past him into the bedroom. So right. He goes and he looks in there. It says the curtain swayed very slightly. And as he saw it, his heart felt as if it had almost missed a beat. Yet he dashed forward and drew them aside with a rush. A window streaming with rain was all that met his gaze. He's doing that thing where he storms around very aggressively, trying to confront his fears. You know, when you think somebody might be in your house, you're like, I'm here, I'm coming downstairs, you know.
I've done that.
He looks at the closets. There's nothing but clothes in there hanging motionless, which actually I think is a great horror beat. That's exactly how he writes it. Held nothing but rows of clothes hanging motionless. He wants you to notice that they're motionless for a moment. It's increasing the tension. Then the character steps backwards into the middle of the room and he trips over something.
Yeah, the kit bag. It's on the floor, not where he left it. So just then, the wind whips up and scares the crap out of him. He does keep it together surprisingly well, but he says out loud, there's no one here at any rate. That's quite clear. You know, trying to convince himself. You know, his mind is playing tricks on him. It's that simple. So he goes back to the front room and he pokes the fire to flare it up a bit.
Oh,
Ouch, my neck. Ouch, my neck got strangled by these headphones.
Did you just hear that, dude?
Hear what?
It sounded like somebody talking about being strangled. Was that just in my...
Ooh, ouch. I'm getting strangled some more.
Do you hear that?
I don't hear anything, man. We got to get back to the show.
Yeah, sorry. I'm just strange.
So outwardly, Johnson is cool and in control, but inside he's freaking out and he's pretty sure someone is messing with him. So he creeps into his room. He thinks maybe somebody crept into his room and they went out the window, but he keeps thinking of the murderer. He keeps thinking of John Turk. And I like this bit here. He says, "Unpleasant, haunting memories have a way of coming to life again just when the mind least desires them. In the silent watches of the night, on sleepless pillows, during the lonely hours spent by sick and dying beds." I thought, yeah.
Sure.
Again, I've been there. It touches on that very familiar feeling.
I think that that's the real beauty of the story, because it's got a plot. It's got a haunted bag. Mm-hmm. But really, it's the relatability of it that wraps you in. It's the feeling of fear that he expresses and the way that he does it. You go, oh, God, I felt that way.
Yeah.
It triggers something in you.
It does.
It's the effect of it that's the more important part.
So he keeps seeing Turk's face and he feels his presence everywhere. But again, he dismisses it because it doesn't make any logical sense. So he plans on just finishing up packing and then he's going to go to bed. He walks back into the bedroom, but his heart sinks again when he sees that the bag is even closer to the door than it was before.
The kit bag lay close in front of him, several feet nearer to the door than he had left it. And just over its crumpled top, he saw a head and face slowly sinking down out of sight, as though someone were crouching behind it to hide. And at the same moment, a sound like a long-drawn sigh was distinctly audible in the still air about him between the gusts of the storm outside. Johnson had more courage and willpower than the girlish indecision of his face indicated, but at first such a wave of terror came over him that for some seconds he could do nothing but stand and stare. A violent trembling ran down his back and legs, and he was conscious of a foolish, almost a hysterical impulse to scream aloud. That sigh seemed in his very ear, and the air still quivered with it. It was unmistakably a human sigh.
That's some scary stuff. It's the motion of the head sinking just out of sight behind the bag.
Yeah.
You know, you're pretty sure you saw it, but... You know, as a kid, I was always sure there was somebody out in the hallway, just out around the side of the open door to my bedroom.
Yeah.
And as I'd lean over to see it, to see if they were there, I could swear the person or thing or whatever it was backing away at the same time. So you just catch a glimpse of the outline as you move your head around. It's that effect.
Mm.
Really nice.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, I stayed over at my grandparents' house. They had a farm in Iowa. I slept upstairs. There was one night that I could have sworn I heard somebody walking up the stairs, but nobody came up the stairs. Mm. And I laid there for a long time just trying to figure out what was going on. I think I even got up and looked down the stairs, even though the footsteps sound like they came up the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing. There was nothing there. It was just dark. It's my grandparents' farmhouse out in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty creeped out. I was so creeped out that I just kind of lied down and then eventually went back to sleep. You know, what else are you going to do?
Those stories usually end that way.
Yeah, that's
There's
it.
There's no revelation that...
No answers, no revelation. Probably I was dreaming or I was half awake and...
Ghost of an angry goat or a...
No. I wish there was an angry goat. That would have been a much better story if there was a goat.
Mm.
Like I looked down the stairs and the goat just went, meh.
No! Did you see the goat? There hasn't been a goat here for 25 years.
Suddenly, my grandfather's from New England.
Since we put that goat, what massacred everyone to death?
So, Johnson, after seeing this head go behind the bag, he says, "Who's there?" Of course, again, no answer. So he walks over, he looks behind the bag, and nobody's there. When he looks at the bag for the first time, he notices that there are some blood stains on it. And seeing this makes Johnson scream. And then the bag moves forward a bit towards the door, and Johnson falls back onto the door, closing it and sliding to the floor. Now it's completely dark in the room, and he reaches to turn on the light, but he can't quite get to it. And he could hear the bag shuffling across the floor and this human sigh.
And it's funny that you're finding any of this scary, but you do when you're reading the story.
Oh, yeah.
But when you think about it, he's afraid that he's going to get attacked by a bag of his own clothes in the dark. It's a hard one to pitch when you're trying to relate a story like, Okay, I got the story I want to write. Now, have you ever shut off the lights and then you hear a noise in the dark and you think, wait a minute, where are my swim trunks? Have you ever had that fear? That's what this story, The Kit Bag, is going to be all about.
Go on.
But it works.
It works, yeah. It's really good, the story. So as Johnson fumbles around, he wonders, you know, maybe it's better that I don't see what's in this room. But he needs to have that light on. He must turn it on to confront whatever it is that's happening. And he flicks on the light. When he does, he sees standing before him the murderer, John Turk. Totally there, totally real.
Yeah, that's a little different than just getting slapped by your extra pair of socks. That's a real manifestation.
And then it clicks. Johnson remembers that a bag like this was the same bag that Turk used to put dismembered body parts into with lime. And he also added in a little bit of cayenne pepper.
Did he? Is that in the story?
Well, okay. If you put lime in, you gotta have a little spice in there.
A little cayenne, a little heat.
This, he realizes, was actually the bag that had body parts put into it. Johnson, he stands and he tries to open the door, and Turk slowly looks up at him and he says, "It's my bag. I want it." So Johnson, all he remembers after that point was getting out the door, falling on the landing and fainting. Mm-hmm. And then he remembers waking up, remembering what happened, and then fainting again.
Yes! The double faint. And this is an older story, so you think, you know, we rag on Lovecraft for all the fainting, but compared to this, he was restrained.
Yeah.
He was actually pulling the fainting back a little bit to more believable realms of fainting activity.
Yeah, he's like, well, one faint is enough, but not Blackwood, man. He's like, we got a 1-2 faint here.
Oh, man, I must have fainted. Oh, my God, that thing that happened to me! And out again.
He remembers getting up yet again after the second faint, but not fainting the third time.
No.
And making his way to the armchair and using his coat as a blanket and then falling asleep. In the morning, he is awoken by Mrs. Monks. She says that there is a man from Wilbraham's office to see him, and she shows him up. He apologizes and says that, I'm so sorry, you got the wrong kit bag delivered to you. This was the one from the court case. It was John Turk's bag.
It says, Henry, who I guess is the guy who gave it to him, who brought it over before, Henry somehow got a hold of the one that came over from the courtroom, and Mr. Wilbraham only discovered it when he saw his own lying in his room and asked why it had not gone to you. I hope Henry got fired for that, because that's quite a mistake.
Yeah.
How many other times has he mixed up packages that were supposed to be sent from the lawyer with evidence from a murder case?
So this man gives Johnson a replacement bag, but then Johnson says, would you please go into my bedroom and unpack that other bag and, you know, just dump the clothes on the floor, because I don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, he doesn't want to touch the bag, but I mean, would you keep any of those clothes that you had packed in there?
Yeah. Why wouldn't you?
A dismembered woman's body was shoved into that thing and was in there for a while. The bloodstains are still on it. I would just throw all those clothes out.
What? But just because it touched a bag that touched a dead person?
Dude, I couldn't. That would be bad. I wouldn't want them.
Would you get rid of your clothes if they touched clothes that touched a bag that touched a dead person?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Would you
just keep going with it, because it all ends with me being naked?
The man goes into the bedroom and he comes out with the bag.
Thank you, sir, the man said, returning with the bag folded over his arm. And can I do anything more to help you, sir? What is it? Asked Johnson, seeing that he still had something he wished to say. The man shuffled and looked mysterious. Beg pardon, sir, but knowing your interest in the Turk case, I thought you'd maybe like to know what happened. Yes? John Turk killed himself last night with poison immediately on getting his release, and he left a note for Mr. Wilbraham saying he'd be much obliged if they'd have him put away, same as the woman he murdered, in the old kit bag. What time did he do it? Asked Johnson. 10 o'clock last night, sir, the warder says.
And that's the end of the story.
That's the end. And if you recall, when everything started going wacky, it was at 10 o'clock.
It was at 10 o'clock. Turk wanted to be buried in his own kit bag. That's why he was coming for it. That's why he wanted it.
Yeah, that's weird. Murder somebody and then put them in a kit bag. And then you're like, you know what? When I die, I want to be put in that kit bag. Why?
Insanity. I guess it was true. He really was insane.
I guess it was true.
I liked the story.
Man, I liked it a lot. Yeah, it was really good, really scary. And again, I don't really get creeped out when I'm reading a story, but this one got me a few times. Like when he starts heading back to his room and he hears somebody run up the stairs behind him, it's like, whoa.
And as silly as it is for this kit bag to be sort of making a face of this murderer, it is odd things like that turn out to be scarier than anything sometimes. Just shapes in a room can really
wreck your head. Even just small things, a blanket thrown over a chair or a cardboard cutout of Captain Picard.
How can that ever be scary? That's ridiculous.
In the dark.
Even in the dark, that would fill me with security.
Next week, we've got a story called A Christmas Reunion, and that's by Sir Andrew Caldecott, whom we've not read before, at least not in my recollection.
No.
So that'll be all new territory for us, and I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. And I'm also looking forward to thanking some patrons, so why don't I do that right now?
Sure.
I want to thank James Bobes.
I want to thank Andrew Doss.
I would like to thank John Gaffney.
Blythe Noble Hager, thank you.
I would like to thank Robert Johnson.
Michael Kirwan.
I would also like to thank Stella B.
Jonas Rullo, thank you.
Nick Booth, you're grand.
And thank you very much, Christina Bagenstoss. Everybody, thank you so much for being part of our team here and churning out the content. I hope you're having a good holiday season, and I hope we're good accompaniment for that. We'll be back next week with a Christmas reunion, but that's all we have for now. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Ouch, my neck. I've been strangled a whole bunch by these headphones. Ooh, it hurts.
I can't. Anyway, HP Podcraft, we're at hppodcraft.com. Do you hear that?
Hear what?
Oh, man.
hppodcraft.com.